All right, guys, welcome to Property Profits Podcast. I'm your host, Bryce Kaminsky, filling in for Dave Dubow. And have you ever wondered how someone could turn a $20,000 loss into a thriving real estate portfolio of over 70 properties? Today, my guest, Megan Ahern, originally from Lincoln, Nebraska, zooming in from Maui today, not only conquered the real estate game, but has also found a unique path to success through sober living houses. Megan, welcome to the show. Excited to dive into your incredible journey.
Hey, Bryce, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So let's start with the thing that's most interesting to me. Tell me about sober living houses.
So we rent to a program called Oxford House, and then they run the programming behind it and they fill the beds. So for us, it's super passive, but it allows us to add more doors without any more headaches. And we usually sign those for like 3-year leases. So they're really passive.
Yeah, I have a couple of investor friends who leverage these programs because they essentially do all the management. All you are is like the house. They have a inflated rent because of the type of use, and they typically do sign like 3 or 5 year leases. So it's a great income generating strategy we're also providing a service with these particular types of units. Do you find that, do you find that you have to pick particular properties for these clients to come on board, or are they pretty much okay with anything you bring them?
It's a very specific property that they're looking for. And once you kind of figure out what that is, it's honestly really easy to find, usually even on the MLS, because they're larger houses. So ours are usually 8-bedroom, 3-bath. And so if I'm looking on the MLS for a 6-bed, 3-bath, and I know I can add bedrooms in the basement, nobody really wants a 6-bedroom house. Like a normal family wouldn't want that. So they kind of sit on the market, and we can usually pick them off pretty easy.
And where do you primarily find these properties? Like what market are we talking about?
Lincoln, Nebraska, and then some of the surrounding small towns.
Yeah. So is the, because typically these 6-bedroom houses are like older units from when people were building mansions when they had like 13 kids or something like that. So are you finding that that's the type of inventory, or is what's the type of inventory that you're coming across when it comes to finding these things?
Yeah, usually kind of those mini mansions, 100-year-old houses. What we have too is called like conversion multifamilies, where they would have taken those big mini mansions and then chopped them up into a fourplex. And they're always kind of weird and kind of funky layouts. And so we'll deconvert them back into big single families, and then they work perfect for the Oxford House program.
Yeah, they'll have like 4 little kitchens and 4 like shower only bathrooms that some landlord did in the 80s or something. I remember
they
converted.
Put like a kitchen in the closet. It's always like really terrible.
Yeah. And it's fairly, what I like about that is there's usually plumbing all over the house. So you can figure out, oh, I could put a better kitchen, at least maybe on the second floor. So what sort of challenges do you come up with when doing these sort of conversions? Because I can remember when we did a couple conversions, it's really a challenge dealing with the city because we're doing these retrofits of these 100-year-old houses.
Yeah, for us, the city would like them to be deconverted into single families more than they would want them converted into multifamilies. So they're usually pretty lenient with us when we're removing kitchens and removing units than, you know, adding more.
Yeah, because then the thing I guess becomes more valuable to the neighborhood. They don't really want multi-units maybe so much, especially those times. Like if you're going to have 4 units, build something new, make it right. These conversions sometimes with the like third story low ceiling, and it's just like, okay, this is probably a better bedroom than it is a kitchen. So is that primarily where these 70 properties come into play, or how did you wind up with so many doors?
So they're all in Lincoln, Nebraska and the surrounding towns. Some of those, you know, are flips. Some of them we wholesale. Some of them are rentals. We have some duplexes and some, we now have a 7-unit, like a small multifamily property, but all in Nebraska.
Nice, nice. So what do you like most about the way you've been doing real estate lately?
Right now, we've been doing a lot of financing with the banks. So they'll finance 100% of the purchase and 100% of the rehab a lot of times on bank financing. And so I was just back in Nebraska this last couple of weeks, meeting with more lenders, just always looking for different kind of money options that will finance like the entire project. And it helps us to be able to grow faster.
Yeah, with the bank, you know, it's a little bit challenging for a lot of people, but it seems that especially in the United States, in some markets anyways, I'm not going to say all markets, but that they are pro investor. You know, if you can find the right connections, that you can get surprisingly 100% of the purchase, 100% of the renovation, and it makes it really smooth. So what maybe isn't so great about what's going on these days?
I think there's a softening in our market, and obviously everything is very local in real estate, but I think there was a big softening on the coast maybe about a year ago, and now we're kind of seeing that delayed reaction happening in the Midwest. So it is taking longer for our flips to sell, and we're just not used to that. Like, that's still statistically pretty average, historically average. But we're so used to like flip selling in 24 hours and multiple offers and all that.
Yeah, that's the one thing that, you know, if you haven't been in real estate for a very long time, or even just maybe like 5 or 10 years, you can remember that like 5 or 10 years ago, that selling within the days on market was like a success. You're like, oh, it's 20 days to sell in this market. We sold in 15. Hooray. And then we got kind of used to that 2020, 2021, where something would go up and, you know, there'd be agents in there and you'd be getting offers that day and you'd be, you know, closing in, you know, a month from that day. So it is a little bit of a cooling back to like what realtors like to call a balanced market, which I think is their way of saying like things are just back to normal, right? So have there been any sort of major challenges you've had to overcome in your real estate journey so far?
Our first deal, we did a long distance flip. We lost 20 grand on that. You had kind of alluded to earlier. So that was obviously a big hit right from the beginning. It was a big challenge, but I think it was such a good learning process. I think that you can't pay $20,000 to learn as much as we did. And it just helps to go through the motions and take that lesson.
Yeah, that you learn a lot more from losing than you do from winning. You know, winning is a bad teacher. So with that, what would you do would have done, blah blah blah. What would you have done differently if you could do it again?
I would have trusted, more experienced investors. So I had tried to wholesale it because it was a long distance deal and couldn't wholesale it. And I thought that was just because, I don't know, that they didn't know what they were talking about or whatever. And if I would have taken the advice of more experienced flippers and when they said, hey, this isn't actually a deal, I should have taken that instead of saying, okay, well, I'll just try to flip it myself. I didn't understand closing costs and commissions and holding costs, and then doing a rehab from a long distance with Craigslist contractors and all that. It obviously went longer and over budget, so I learned
Yeah,
a lot of
definitely.
lessons.
Well, and that's the thing is that you know, whenever you get lender hesitation or wholesale hesitation, you have to wonder, is this a deal? Like, what do they know that I don't know? And early on, you know, I've even been caught by that, thinking that I know better than the market and the other people, and then all of a sudden, there you go, you've got a loss on your hands. But you know, let's forward to today. You know, when it comes to real estate investing, Robert Kiyosaki has a book, Unfair Advantage. What would you say comes easy to you guys that other people might find difficult to do?
I think our design piece of our flipping is kind of what makes us stand apart, at least from others in Lincoln. I think up to the point of us coming into the market, there was a lot of like just gray walls, blah flooring, and we kind of brought HGTV style to the Midwest. They're like 10 years behind on all of that. And that kind of sets us apart to be able to get those top dollars for our flips.
Yeah, really the pictures, a lot of people are shopping for houses on MLS and then they'll go and see, okay, well, what does it look like and what does it feel like in person? And with, you had mentioned that one of the businesses that you guys do is staging. How does that play into your real estate flipping, I guess? And probably, you know, in the past, we've staged some of our rentals as well for the photos. How does staging play into your success in real estate?
Yeah, I think it's huge. The Association of Realtors did a study and they said that stage houses sell for 9% more than unstaged houses. And so when I first started flipping in Nebraska, I wanted to stage my houses, but I couldn't find a good option that was like, I call it the Chick-fil-A of staging. Like it's decent, it's consistent, but it doesn't have to be over the top. Like if you want filet mignon, go get filet mignon, but I didn't need that. It was more of like a first-time home buyer price point. And so I felt like there was a void in that staging market. So I created a company and now we stage about 80 houses a year in Lincoln.
Wow.
Some of those are mine, my flips, because I wanted to be able to do that. And some of them are my listings. But I do think it really helps, especially now that the market slowed down a little bit to, you know, put your best foot forward.
Oh yeah, definitely. In the slower markets, the staging can definitely be the difference. The only challenge is like paying the next month. And that's not a challenge for people who own staging companies. Back in the day when we were flipping, we had the staging company. So when month two came up and the house was sitting, we didn't have to necessarily pay again, but certainly the people renting, well, you got to pay the rent on that furniture for month two. Now, you're zooming in from Maui. Do you guys do this business remotely now, or is this a vacation for you? What does that look like for running the business?
We moved here in May and we'll probably be here about a year. We just have been working so much, like 100-hour work weeks for the first 5 years of running our business, and then wanted to be able to take a little break. So we have our teams back home and we're still flipping and buying rentals as much as we ever were and staging more than we ever were. But we don't have to be hands-on in it anymore.
So what would you say to someone who's interested in turning their business into like a remote thing? What was something that you found success in when separating yourself from the market? What were some challenges and maybe some ways you overcame that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just, you know, creating those systems and practicing removing yourself even when you're still there. I think that we've been building a business in the way of, you know, knowing that we would want to be able to remove ourselves. So we've been working on that for a year or 2 years before ever removing ourselves so that we have good processes. We use like Podio to manage all of our projects. And we even manage our staging business through that. And then just hiring like really great people and paying them well so they can take care of everything that you take care of.
And that's one thing it seems that recurs time and time again with that question is that we spent some time intentionally planning to be out. It's not like you can just be like, okay, I'm leaving. It's that there was an intentional plan to kind of have an exit strategy where you could actually do this remotely. And I like what you said there, practicing that even when you're at home and saying like, no, I'm not getting in the car. I'm going to leverage my team. And I'm going to get a result and I'm going to stay home today. So where do you see the business in the next 12 months? You know, what are your goals and aspirations for 2024?
I think we'll probably flip about 20 houses and then we'll probably add another 20 or so to our rental portfolio. So just keep it chugging along and keep growing.
Yeah, just keep on doing what has worked so far. So with all the things you guys have accomplished in the business, what would you say your biggest obstacle is these days?
Probably finding great contractors to kind of keep up with that pace. Yeah, that was one of the main things going back about a week ago to like re-meet with contractors and interview them and look at their projects and see like, can you work professionally and can you stay on a timeline? Because when we have projects stacking up, it's just like so frustrating with the money costs and projects sitting there. I think it's probably our biggest headache right now.
Yeah, contractors, the necessary, I'm not going to say the necess I'll just say it, necessary evil of the flipping business is that, what I found, especially when we were doing our flips, and maybe you can talk to this, is that when you use a contractor for so long, they eventually become unaffordable and you have to replace them because they start doing great work, and that's great. But at some point they're like, we can't really do business anymore because you're unaffordable against my margins. So how do you manage the margins with your contractors these days to keep them in the business?
There is some of that. And I just feel like, we can usually grow with them too. And I don't always look for the cheapest contractor. I think you end up paying more when you hire the cheapest guys. But
That's so true.
I think that we're just growing faster than they'll grow or they can grow as businessmen, because I think that most contractors, at least in the Midwest, like they want to do a good job. They're not trying to steal from me. They're not trying to take too long. But it's like, if we have five projects and four crews, they can only go so fast. And so I think it's just a constant, like trying to find more and then just supporting them in whatever way we can to make their projects go as smooth as possible.
Yeah, I would always say to new investors, I would say contractors have three skills, time, like the fa how fast they can do it, the quality and the price. And you can really only get two of the three, and the third quadrant is what you're going to have to fulfill. So if you've got a contractor that is maybe slow but cost effective and has good quality, you kind of have to be the person to say, let's go, let's go, let's go, because that one quadrant is the reason that they're able to be cost effective. So how do you manage your crews in that way? Like, do you have working knowledge of maybe their weak power points, or how do you make sure that those four crews can do five jobs?
We just kind of stay on them. We're in our projects often. And we're just open communication to saying like, hey, if you need one of my people or my runners to go get some material for you or whatever to keep the job pressing forward, we're open to that. And just kind of want to have that open lines of communication back and forth. Or if there is a delay, at least I want to know why. Or if there's something we could do to fix it.
Yeah, so like supporting them at a distance still, because obviously you're not in Nebraska right now. So supporting them and making sure that the project moves forward, that's great. So you'd mentioned that you're funding a lot of your projects with bank financing. Has it always been that way? And how much more can the bank handle for what you plan to do this year?
It hasn't always been that way. We've done a lot of like hard money. We were paying 18% hard money on our flips in the beginning. And then we started getting those bank relationships and paying, 4.5% back in the good old days, with the banks. And so each bank has like a limit, depending on how many deposits they have in their bank, will limit the amount that they'll lend to any borrower. And usually like 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, those kind of smaller banks is who we work with. But we're just always meeting new banks kind of as we fill up on those limits. So I think the stuff that we have in the pipeline, we definitely have bank lenders for, but those quick turnaround funds, we use private money a lot, for those. Like if I know I can get in and get out and flip a house in a couple months, I might just use like private financing, private lending type loans, because it might not be worth going through all the headache and process of like an appraisal and getting a spec appraisal and setting up the line of credit for the rehab and all of those things when I can just get it done easily.
Yeah, that's the bonus of private capital. Well, it might not be as cheap as the bank, although the bank isn't necessarily the cheapest money either these days, but it's the access, I think, it's most been most important in my career anyway, is just being like, let's go, and they're in, and the money's at the lawyer's office, and it's speed seems to be the big bonus when it comes to private capital. You're just convincing them, hey, these are the numbers, this is the deal, are you in? And typically you can move it pretty quickly. So how much private capital would you say you plan to use this year versus the bank capital for people wondering, how do I do what she's doing? How do I do what they're doing?
I'll probably be rolling about $1 million of private capital at any one time. kind of throughout the year. A lot of times we'll do like the purchase and rehab on that private capital and then push it to bank financing and kind of a BRRRR strategy for our rentals. So it just kind of depends on the deal.
So what have you found to be most effective to keep in touch with this private capital base, your investors, as the deals come and the business goes? Like, how do you find, you know, the way to keep them engaged with your business?
Mostly through my Instagram. So I'm the Tatty Investor on Instagram. And so I get a lot of my lenders from that. And then they can also stay in touch with like what I'm doing and what kind of projects I have going on.
So Instagram's been, so social media is one way that you've been able to collect and keep engaged the investors that you have. So when looking for deals, do you find, are you like a find the deal and then the money, or do you prefer to have your capital lined up and go looking for deals?
I like having my capital lined up. I like to have options. And so when I am starting to talk to sellers, I'll know like, who am I going to go to on this? And if they say, hey, I want to close in a week, okay, I know I got to go to Kevin because he can make it happen like that. Or if they're like, oh, we could close in a month or a month and a half, then maybe I'll fart around with the banks and get it done that way.
Yeah. So with the presentation, you know, there's always a presentation when it comes to raising capital. As a business, are you guys raising by the deal still, or have you transitioned to something that's more business based? Like, this is who we are, you're investing in us. Or do you find that you still need to do deal based lending when it comes to your private money?
I think that most of our private investors know that we know what we're doing. And so they're doing less due diligence on the deal and more trusting in us and our abilities to perform on that. I think a lot of times, even when a private lender looks at Zillow comps or Zestimate, they're not going to see what I know to be the ARV. So I think they have to just trust me a lot of times.
Yeah, just trust me. It'll be good.
Just trust me. It's fine. I'm a realtor. And, you know, some people are more into it and want to really know the numbers. And some of them are just like, send me the checks in the mail. I don't really care where it's at or what you're doing. It just depends.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you made a good point there. As a realtor, you do have your finger on the pulse, as you're not just dealing with your own properties, you're also selling other properties. And so how much does being a realtor help you with the business that you're in now?
I think it helps a lot because, like you said, you know, we get those market stats. I can pull MLS data. I can pull comps very accurately. And then we are selling our clients' listings and other people's houses, and we're very attuned to what's happening in the market. I think that makes lenders feel comfortable. And then I think it also allows us to know or feel changes in the market before just listing a flip.
Yeah, that definitely, there's the forecasting. It's never been more important than it has in the last, say, year, because it was kind of easy to, this is going to sell. But now it's like, okay, what exactly is selling and how long and why? And, you know, you have to be a little bit more of a savvy investor. So with the people that are investing with you, you know, they're investing significant amounts typically. With that being said, they typically need to know and like and trust you. Where do you think that comes from, where these people, where you're saying, oh, just trust me? Where is that, you know, how do you build those sort of faculties into what you do on a daily basis to get people to know you, like you, ultimately trust you to invest?
Yeah, I do a lot of networking and I love meeting people. And I think people just kind of get a certain feeling about somebody by meeting them. Like, we have honesty, we have integrity. And honestly, I speak very openly on my Instagram about, hey, I've lost money on this flip. I've lost money on this deal. Like, this is going wrong. And so they see that, like, I'm an open book, but even when my flips are losing money, they're still making their 12% interest or whatever on their money. So they don't really care if I'm losing money on my a flip here and there, right? And it is a numbers game. Like, if you do 50 flips and you lose on three, then you're
That's pretty
still
good.
making money. You're still fine.
Yeah, typically the ratios are 7-2-1, 7 wins, 2 break-evens, and 1 loss. So over 50, if you're doing like if you have 3 down deals, then definitely you've got the eye for it. So when it comes to investing, if you were to start all over again, what would you do differently, if anything?
I think a lot of times when we make goals, it actually creates a ceiling for ourselves. So I would probably try to grow bigger, faster, which is maybe a scarier or riskier position to take. But I think that if you make a goal to do 12 a year and you hit it, or you do really well, and maybe you do 13 or 14 a year. But you're not going to accidentally hit 50 a year. Like, you have to rebuild the system completely and kind of back yourself into engineering that system in a different way. So I would just say to like shoot for more quicker.
Yeah, because if you've, if, oh, sorry, I was going to do 50 and I only did half, that's still more than 12, right? That ceiling that we box ourselves into can sometimes be the reason that we only do 12, and maybe that's enough, but I think that letting it kind of go is really where the business could go, letting it go there. And so with all of the things that you guys have accomplished, is there any concerns about the market? Because you're invested in quite a big way, you're I wouldn't say all the eggs are in one basket, but your real estate agents, your rentals, your flips, and there's a lot of people talking about, okay, well, what happens if it keeps getting worse or the interest rate keeps rising? How are you guys preparing for that? Or rather, what's your strategy to kind of navigate what could be? We never really know. It's real estate, it's a market, but what are you doing to prepare for what could be another, let's call it a balanced year?
I think one thing is we look back at like 2008, which was obviously catastrophic. And in Nebraska, it only dropped 20% and rents never went down. So, not to say that what happened in 2008 is going to happen now, because we're clearly in a much different situation. But I feel comfortable in that I don't think that the price values will drop below 20% if they even dropped that much. And I think that our rentals will still stay full. Lincoln is a very, very strong rental market. And so for us, it's just a matter of, building up cash, I think, flipping a little bit more, and then just being very conservative with our numbers and trying to do projects that we can get in and get out of quickly, because the market isn't going to change that drastically in 3 months, but I might not want to take on like a year project where I'm completely gutting it to the studs and rebuilding all the stuff. Just get in and get out with more cosmetic type projects.
Yeah, stay short in the market, especially if you're flipping. Things could change. The tide could change. That's great advice. So if people want to find out more, they want to connect with you, what should they do?
Reach out to me on Instagram at the underscore tatty underscore investor.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you stopping by, and hopefully everyone doesn't just flood into your Lincoln market now that they know the secret's out. So hopefully we just have a few and it doesn't, saturate your market now that they know that it's a great place to invest. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. If they do want to invest in Lincoln, I'm a realtor, so I can help them find
There you
deals.
go. There you go. Well, I really appreciate it. And until next time, guys, we'll catch you on the next episode.